Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for coming tonight. My name is Andrew Berman. I'm the Executive Director of the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. And all of you who are here early know that in light of recent developments, we decided to add on kind of a little discussion/Q&A session before the lecture by Professor Dolkart about what's happened in the last couple of weeks in relation to WestVet, State National Register listing, landmarking, etc. I, unfortunately, although it works out well in terms of the timing, have to leave it a little bit after 7. So for those who do have questions about this issue, make sure you get it out now, and then Professor Dolkart will come up here and he's going to talk about the incredible research that he's done over the last several years that went into the writing of the State National Register nomination. So everybody should have on their chair, among many other things, and I'll give a more general introduction to the evening at 7 o'clock. This double-sided handout, which gives a little bit of background information about some of the preservation efforts in the last couple of years in relation to the Far West Village and WestVet. And it helps to give sort of a little bit of context to how we got to this point in time, although I know there are a lot of people in the room who have been very involved over the years in various ways with preservation efforts here in the neighborhood. But let me just step back a little bit to kind of bring us to where we are today. As many of you know, first of all, of course, since the 1960s, there's been a concerted effort to try to get landmark protections and to prevent overdevelopment here in the Far West Village and along the Greenwich Village waterfront. The Far West Village was left out of the Greenwich Village Historic District that was established in 1969, and while many people toiled very hard for many years to try to change that, there really was little, if not no progress, until the earlier part of this decade. Starting in about 2003, GBSHP, working with local community groups, including WestVet Artists Residence Council, Greenwich Village Community Task Force, Federation, lots of other folks, lots of people in this room, kind of embarked on a new push because we knew it was now or never to get landmark and zoning protections for this neighborhood. And one of the things that we did was we put forward a proposal for a Far West Village Historic District that included WestVet, but also included basically every older building on these blocks from Horatio down to Morton Street, west of Washington. Further south, it went a little bit further east. Ultimately, what the city came back to us with was something that was not quite everything we asked for, although it was significant progress over what we had, which was an extension of the Greenwich Village Historic District. And, you know, the map on the back of that flyer kind of visually illustrates what I'm talking about. An extension of the Greenwich Village Historic District covering 3 blocks, a new Weehawken Street Historic District, and they also promised to designate 8 individual sites in the neighborhood, of which WestVet was one. They moved, well, I wouldn't say quickly, but they moved to designate 3 of those 4 of those 8 sites that they promised within a year or two. Actually, looking here, it took a little bit longer. They did that in 2007. Last year, they designated a building on Horatio Street that they promised to designate, and there's now some movement in terms of WestVet. Now, our preference, of course, would have been to have had a district that covered everything. It wasn't our idea to say single out WestVet and have WestVet landmarked without necessarily everything else around it being landmarked, but sometimes you sort of take what you can get. The J.M. Kaplan Fund, which had a role in the original birth of WestVet, actually approached GBSHP to say, we would like to work with you to see if we can get the entire WestVet complex listed on the State and National Register of Historic Places. And I'm going to give you the sort of quick and simple summary of the distinction between the State National Register and landmarking. The State National Register, if you're listed on the State National Register, generally speaking, it doesn't mean that there is a mechanism to prevent demolition or alteration. It does a few things. It provides incentives for preservation, such as grants, loans, tax abatements for preservation work. It also, in a sense, puts you in the state and federal history books, so to speak, for being significant for whatever the reason is that you've been listed on the state and national register. It can have a more regulatory role if the state or the federal government is involved. And we'll get back to that in a second. But it does not per se say this building cannot be demolished or this building cannot be altered. It's incentives, it's honor, and it's state and federal regulation if the state or federal government is involved. New York City landmark designation, by contrast, which is a thing that we've been sort of talking about that we were fighting for to get for the whole waterfront, that, in essence, does have the power to prevent demolition of buildings or to prevent alteration of them in a way that would be deemed inconsistent with the historic qualities. Now that I've sort of given you that little bit of summary, going back a few years ago, the J.M. Kaplan Fund did approach GBSHP and said, we'd like to work with you to get Westbeth listed on the State National Register of Historic Places, specifically about the history of its conversion from the old Bell Telephone Labs to the Westbeth Housing for Artists. One of the buildings, the West Street building of the Westbeth complex, was already listed on the State National Register of Historic Places years ago, but it was listed specifically because of the Bell telephone history. Nothing having to do with Westbeth, nothing having to do with artist housing, none of that was recognized or acknowledged when the state and federal government said this place is of historic significance. So what we were asked to do was a whole new thing, not just for Westbeth, but basically for any place in the country to be listed on the State National Register of Historic Places for being artist housing, adaptive reuse of industrial buildings. Something so recent as well was kind of unique, because generally speaking, to be listed on the State National Register of Historic Places, the site or the event that it commemorates has to be at least 50 years old, and of course the conversion in the late 1960s was less than 50 years ago. So when we were approached by the J.M. Kaplan Fund, we of course eagerly agreed, and we immediately reached out to the Westbeth Board, as well as the Westbeth Artists Residence Council, and let them know that this was a project that we were seeking to embark upon, and asked for assistance and cooperation, and we got a lot of great input and help. Took a long time. There's a lot of history to research. Among other things that were done, we had to track down a lot of the people who were involved in the conversion 40 years ago, do interviews with them to get some of the history that hadn't necessarily been written down anywhere. That turned into an oral history project, which is actually now on our website. You can read it or listen to it, and the handout has information about how you can get to it if you want to. And after a couple of years of research and Professor Gokhart, who you'll hear from later, putting that together, we had what seemed to be a successful nomination to be submitted to the state to say, here is what we think is full documentation of why what happened here in the late 1960s is so significant, in fact, extraordinarily significant, which is the criteria that the state and federal government use, that even though it happened less than 50 years ago, we think you should be putting this on the State and National Register of Historic Places, recognizing how important it is, and by virtue of that, also giving the Westbeth complex the opportunity to pursue some of the grants or loans, etc., that it could potentially qualify for because of listing on the State and National Register of Historic Places. As I think all of you at this point know, a couple of weeks ago, the State Historic Preservation Board, which is in charge of overseeing these applications, voted unanimously to accept it, which was great news. We were thrilled about that. And now it's just basically going through the bureaucratic process of being finalized. It has to be signed by an appointee of the governor. Then they send it off to the federal government. The federal government spends a couple of weeks or months reviewing it. And in almost every case, the federal government accepts what the state has sent to them. Now, we, throughout the past several years, have been pushing the Landmarks Preservation Commission, and now we're going back to the city landmarking side of things, to follow through on the commitment that they made in 2004 about the two historic districts and the eight individual designations, one of which was Westmount. When we had the report with these 3 years of research put together, and we knew that it was going through the state process, we gave that to the city's Landmarks Preservation Commission, because one of the reasons why the city often says, well, yeah, we could do that, but, you know, we're not going to do it right now, or we don't have time, or maybe some point in the future, is they say, well, you know, it's a lot of work to designate something. There has to be a lot of research, there has to be a lot of documentation. So we basically said, here, we just spent the last 3 years doing all of this research and documentation. We're going to give it to you. It should make your job much easier. So following the state accepting that nomination and moving forward, as I think a lot of you know, just this past week on Tuesday, the Landmarks Preservation Commission voted to what's called calendar Westbeth for landmark designation. What that means is it's now officially on the Landmarks Preservation Commission's docket. They will schedule a hearing. And by the way, all of this was preceded by, and has to be preceded by, notification to and conversations with the owners, which in this case would be the Westbeth Board, about the potential designation. I know that the Board of Westbeth recently sent around a letter, which I've seen, about the potential impending designation. So what's going to happen is at some point in the hopefully not too distant future, there will be a public hearing, which anybody can go to, sign up, and testify and say, here's what I think about the possibility of Westbeth being landmarked. The commissioners will hear it. They almost never vote at the public hearing. They take some time to think about it. Presumably at some point in the future, they then vote and they either landmark it or they don't. The fact that they've calendared it means that they are very inclined towards landmarking, but they haven't done that yet. It's also not a guarantee. Sometimes things get calendared and they even have a hearing and the commission never does it. I don't think that's going to be the case here, but it certainly doesn't mean, okay, all done, we know exactly what's going to happen. So that's where we are. If they do designate, the building then has an added level of regulation attached to it, which means that for physical changes to the building, particularly the exterior, the Landmarks Preservation Commission has to approve any of those changes to make sure that it's consistent with what are considered the historically significant features of the building. Now, let me just say that in recent years, the commission has designated complexes and buildings that I wouldn't necessarily say are just like Westbeth, because Westbeth is clearly unique. But Westbeth would not be the first place that was either a nonprofit, affordable housing, a converted older building that the commission has landmarked. And I would say that they are certainly conscious of the special issues that buildings like that face. And I think that they at least try to take a practical and pragmatic approach. I don't think the commission ever wants to put regulations on a building such that it would become impractical or unaffordable for those who are responsible for it to live up to those obligations. There is also written into the law, by the way, in case there is ever, it does ever come to the point where somebody says, look, I can't afford to do what landmarking requires of me, to be able to substantiate that and get an exemption. It's very, very rare for a variety of reasons, including the fact that the commission, I think, generally works very hard to make sure that people aren't put in that position. But I can understand that there might be some questions or even some anxiety about what sort of responsibilities or obligations would come to this. And I just want to say that you're not the first place that's had to deal with this question before. And so far, I would say the record has been fairly successful. It's not to say that I'm telling you there would never be any bumps in the road. I would also say that GBSHP, as a community organization, and as one that clearly had a special role in relation to this, would certainly work with Westbeth to make sure that what needed to be done in terms of the upkeep and preservation and ongoing maintenance of the building could be done, and that the commission was working with you to help make that happen. So neither of those two things are finalized, but they're both obviously getting very close. State and National Register, we expect it to be official any day now on the state end, and then it'll follow with the federal government. And again, as I said, that means that there could be grants and other things that you would qualify for preservation, restoration work, etc. It does also mean that as I mentioned before, if the federal or state government are taking any action that affects WestVet, that there is potentially a historic preservation review process that they would have to go through to ensure that action does not negatively impact the important historic qualities of the designated property. Now, in terms of WestVet, that could have some very interesting implications if it ever came to that. I know that HUD plays a role in terms of WestVet and its operation. And part of what is being recognized with the State National Register listing is the fact that this complex was turned into affordable housing for artists. So I'll just sort of leave that at that. We'll have some questions and answers if people want to discuss that further. And as I said, with landmark designation, there would be a public hearing. There's a good chance that the commission would decide, if they've gotten to this point, that they do in fact want to designate, and then that means that WestVet would come under their regulation and physical changes to the building would have to be regulated by the commission. GVSHP would certainly, as we have endeavored to, in partnership with folks here at WestVet, to let everybody know what is happening with any of these new steps when it's been signed by the state, when a hearing has been scheduled by the Landmarks Preservation Commission. So we want you to be able to be a part of the process and to help let you know how you can do that. We're also, of course, always interested in hearing your feedback, your thoughts, your ideas, and your concerns about it. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to open it up to any questions. And because time is limited, I'm going to ask people to please keep it to questions and brief questions. Then, of course, we want to get to the highlight of the evening, which is the lecture from Professor Dolkart. So are there any questions? Let's start over here.
Thank you. I think that we could hope, just for once, to allow the landmarks preservation to let us get at the staff, because the staff are the ones who really, you know, filter through all the material that's sent in. And we have to kind of get them and convince them. And sometimes only once you're allowed to be present while the staff are going through it. But see if we could do that, because there's so much more that can be said to the staff, as well as things that are written down.
So Jesse is saying that the staff at the Landmarks Preservation Commission plays a very important role in terms of designation and regulation. And that's true, and we do often try to reach the staff, and we can be helpful in terms of people here at WestVet being in touch with the staff as well if that's needed. Sir?
If the motivation for landmarking WestVet is the fact that it was an industrial building that was converted for affordable artist use, does that mean that the Landmarks Commission is not interested in the architecture of it?
No. I believe that the Landmarks Preservation Commission is very interested in the architecture, and in fact, they generally will not designate a building or a site unless there is architecture that they feel is worth preserving, because what they really regulate is the physicality of the site. So even if something incredibly significant happened, like George Washington slept there, you know, sort of to use the kind of cliche example, if there's not something about the physicality of the building that they can regulate to say this is what has to be kept to show what's significant about the place, then it's really hard for them to do anything about it. So while all of that history is clearly very important, they must feel that is manifest in the physicality of the place. And I think that includes some of the things that were done in the late 60s and early 70s to convert it from the old labs to housing and artist space. May.
Yes. One of the things that wasn't done way back in 68 during the renovation was the changing of the windows. And I will tell you that this is a concern of our boards. We've been hearing about landmarking because our windows, I mean, many of them are metal. People can't even open them. They have chicken wire in them. And we don't want them like that. We want them, if we're going to change the windows, we want them to be windows that everybody can open and give us as much light as possible. So are we, in some kind of danger. And we don't have the money to do those windows before this landmarking takes place. So.
Well, that's a great question, and I want to say, first of all, I should preface this by saying, just to be clear, GBSHP doesn't regulate in any way. We're not going to be the people that WestBeth would be coming to, but I'm going to give you my best sort of opinion about that. The Landmarks Preservation Commission never says to anybody, you're landmarked, you can't change your windows. They may well have an opinion about what kind of windows are the appropriate ones to go in. I will tell you that I've seen many affordable housing complexes that are under the regulation of the Landmarks Preservation Commission that have changed their windows, and obviously it was done in a way that was affordable to them because they were able to do it. The commission also, and I would strongly encourage, whether it's the board or the Artist Council or whoever, to have these conversations, and they've probably started already, with the commission now and say, look, this is going to be an issue. Tell us what you're thinking about what you think we're going to need to do here, and let's talk about how affordable that is for us or how realistic that is for us. Just recently, the Silver Towers complex, built in the 1960s, was landmarked. One of those three towers is a Mitchell-Lama affordable housing. I know that the window replacement is an issue there as well. I had encouraged them also to speak to the commission in advance about some of those basic maintenance and restoration issues. And so it's a common part of what needs to be considered in a situation like this. And so all I can say is it's not untread ground, and I would offer us as a resource to help you guys through it. Now,
is the WestBeth that we're talking about including plans for it, including the I building?
Everything on this block is included. Everything. Any other questions?
Well, yeah. Would we then have two reasons for being landmarked because of the original reason and this one? So
it would
be a double reason?
Well, the commission hasn't yet. First of all, they haven't even held a hearing, much less voted, but my sense is that the Landmarks Preservation Commission would be looking at all of the layers of WestBeth's history. So everything from the incredible things that took place when this was the Bell Telephone Labs, you know, the first talkie, the transatlantic telegraph being invented. I can't even remember the dozens of unbelievable technological innovations that took place here, to the conversion. Is my sense of what they will. And the commission, by the way, has a more recent threshold. For them, 30 years is the dividing line. So the conversion took place more than 30 years ago, so it's wholly within their jurisdiction to be able to say that what happened in the late 1960s with the conversion is part of what we are commemorating, honoring, and seeking to preserve. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Is the artist part of this as important as the industrial building turned into apartments?
Well, good question. Did everybody hear, by the way, is the artist part as important as the sort of conversion part? I'm not sure that there's an answer to that in the sense that they're not necessarily quantified. You know, they don't say, all right, we give 10 points to the artist part of it and we give 15 points to the conversion part of it. What I will say is the Landmarks Preservation Commission does look mostly at the sort of physicality of the building as opposed to the use of it. And in fact, the Landmarks Preservation Commission doesn't certainly does not regulate what the use is, although sometimes in terms of documenting the history and talking about why it's significant, they will talk about what some of the uses were. The State and National Register is a little broader in terms of what they look at, and the State and National Register listing clearly was very much focused on the conversion from an industrial building to artist housing and the sort of revolutionary aspect of that and what WestBeth became. So, and one of the things that's on this handout that we gave you, and Professor Dolkart is going to talk about this in greater detail, is the actual nomination and report that was submitted to the State Register, which was accepted, where in great detail it talks about why what happened in 1968 was so significant. So you can sort of see for yourself what that statement of significance is. Seeing no other hands, I'm going to... If anybody is standing, we do actually have quite a few seats scattered throughout here, especially up front. So it's going to be a much more enjoyable evening for you if you're seated. So feel free to come forward now. So I'm going to now do sort of general introductions, especially since a lot of people came in. And I'm going to apologize for having to run out of here shortly after I do that. But first of all, welcome again to everybody. The Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation, for anybody who doesn't know, is a community-based organization founded in 1980. We work very hard to educate about and to advocate for preservation of the unique historic qualities of our neighborhood. You have a newsletter on your chair along with membership information if you're interested in joining or finding out more about GVSHP. We also asked you to sign up when you came in so we can keep you informed about programs like this, as well as the other work that we do. I want to thank the West Bend Artists Residence Council for co-sponsoring and for giving us this wonderful space tonight to have this event. I also want to ask everybody to have on your chair these program feedback forms. Please do feel free. It'll take you like a minute. Fill them out. Let us know what you think. It helps us make better programming. And we do programs like this basically about once a week, and we want to do the best possible programming that we can. So moving on to our star feature of the evening, I'd like to introduce Professor Andrew S. Stolkart, who's the director of the Historic Preservation Program and the James Marston Fish Associate Professor of Historic Preservation. He's a graduate of Columbia University and Columbia's Historic Preservation Program. He's been active in historic preservation in New York City for over 30 years, both as a staff member at the Landmarks Preservation Commission, as a freelance consultant, and as a teacher. He has worked extensively with neighborhood groups on preservation efforts and has completed scores of National Register nominations, Landmarks Commission designation reports, and historic resource surveys for environmental reviews. Andrew has also written extensively about his passion, the architecture and development of New York City, including the award-winning Morningside Heights, A History of Its Architecture and Development, and Biography of a Tenement House in New York City, An Architectural History of 97 Orchard Street. His latest book, The Row House Reborn, Architecture and Neighborhoods in New York City, 1908 to 1929, was published in the fall of 2009. We're not only honored to have him here tonight, but he's actually going to be doing a lecture for us about that recent book quite soon. And as I mentioned to you before, Professor Dolkart wrote and researched the nomination that was submitted about West Bend, and he's going to talk about that, give a presentation, and take some questions. So please join me in welcoming Professor Andrew Dolkart.
It's a little strange for me, a complete outsider, to be doing this today, since I know a lot of you are residents here, and know a lot more about the intricacies of life at West Bend than I could ever know. And so that's something I'm not really going to deal with tonight. So let me say a few words first about how I got involved with researching West Bend and what I've been doing. I'm an architectural historian, as Andrew said, and I'm specializing in New York City. And I'm also a preservationist. So I like to combine these two things, how architectural history and preservation could work together. I frequently work on National Register nominations for New York City properties. So when I got this request from Joan Davidson at the Kaplan Fund about would I be interested in doing a National Register nomination for West Bend, I said, well, this is right up my alley. I'd love to do it. But this is interesting. This complex was interesting to me for other reasons beyond the usual, well, it's architecturally and historically significant reasons. That is the importance of West Bend in the history of historic preservation in America, which is something that is really something that has really been ignored, is the history of the modern preservation movement, which dates back to the 1960s. Today, at the end of the first decade of the 21st century, we tend to take the idea of adaptively reusing buildings for granted. just as the notion of artists living in former industrial spaces seems really commonplace to us today. But it was not always the case. In the late 1960s, when West Beth was being planned, few old buildings were being saved, and fewer still were being put to new uses. Nobody talked about adaptive reuse at the time. The plan for West Beth coincides, for example, with the reuse of the Jefferson Market Courthouse as a library. So it's part of this first wave of interest in saving old buildings by giving them new uses. These were projects that were incredibly radical at the time, and I think we've tended to forget how radical these projects were. And only a few artists at the time were surreptitiously living in old industrial lofts, mostly in Soho, and the idea of loft living had yet to become fashionable. So West Beth is of interest to me for its importance in the history of housing and in the importance of the architecture and history of the buildings, but also important because of its history in the historic preservation movement in America. Now, this particular project began when the J.M. Kaplan Fund, particularly Joan Davidson, contacted me and contacted the Greenwich Village Society about the idea of looking into the history of West Beth with the idea that this was important and should be nominated to the National Register, particularly for national significance, which is a very, very high threshold to reach. And a grant was given that allowed for the research for the National Register nomination and also funded an oral history project that was done by Gene Houck that recorded the remembrances of those involved with the creation of the complex and provided many new insights into the conception of the design and the beginnings of the project. The oral history project included interviews with Dixon Bain, who was the administrator at the time of conversion, with Joan Davidson, who was put in charge of the project by her father, who instigated the whole project, by Richard Meyer, then an relatively unknown architect who designed the project, by Todd Williams, now a very well-known architect, who was an associate in Meyer's office, who was hired to work on this project, Anna Steele Clark, who worked at the National Endowment for the Arts when this project was one of their pioneering efforts in urban redevelopment. People from Merce Cunningham's office were interviewed, residents were interviewed, and the upshot of all this work is that, as Andrew said before, the New York State Office of Historic Preservation has just recommended unanimously that West Beth be listed on the state register, which is now guaranteed. They just have to sign the form, and they're going to recommend it to the National Register at the Department of the Interior in Washington, also for national significance. This puts West Beth up in like the top 3 or 4 or 5% of landmarks. Very, very few buildings are listed for their national significance. Almost everything listed on the National Register is for local significance. And the national significance is mostly because of its importance in the history of housing. Unfortunately, the National Register is not ready yet to deal with the history of preservation, but I'm working on it.
Oh,
wait a minute.
We have an image here for you to look at while this is happening.
So, why is West Beth significant? I thought about 10. I came up with 10 reasons. They overlap a little. 10 reasons why West Beth is significant. It's significant as the first, and to this day, the largest publicly and privately financed conversion of an industrial complex into housing for artists in the United States. 2, the conversion of the former Bell Laboratories complex into subsidized housing in 1967 to 69 was planned for a diverse group of artists, not just visual artists, creating 384 apartments, a gallery, a theater, commercial spaces, and a large landscape park and courtyard. It is pioneering adaptive reuse project, as I talked about before, undertaken at the time when the notion of converting obsolete and abandoned industrial complexes into live-work space for artists was a radical notion. The project codified the idea of artists living and working in studios created from obsolete industrial space, a development that had recently begun in an illegal manner in post-industrial sections of New York, such as Soho. The project inspired other projects that converted factories into housing for artists in other American cities. The West Beth project was an important example of the private and public sectors joining together in partnership to create new housing, since planning and funding was undertaken jointly by the recently formed National Endowment for the Arts. In fact, this is one of the very first National Endowment projects, and the private J.M. Kaplan Fund with the assistance of the Federal Housing Authority and the City of New York. The conversion of the former Bell Laboratories lab and factory complex to the West Beth Industrial Complex marks the first inroads of housing into the West Village waterfront area, heralding the major change that would transform the West Village into a residential neighborhood, as we all know. I mean, I think, so those of you who are early residents here, it's pretty hard to believe what's happened to the West Village waterfront in the last decade or so. The conversion project was the first significant work by Richard Meyer, who has gone on to, of course, to become one of the world's most prestigious architects with commissions throughout the United States and Europe. You only need to look at the glass buildings out on West Street. The design, very controversial, I know, I actually like those buildings, but I know I'm probably in the minority in this room. The design itself was innovative in the United States with its duplex units and its interest in preserving key aspects of the old complex, especially on the interiors. And it exemplifies a new housing type invented in the 1960s, loft living, or converting abandoned industrial space into live workspace. So this evening, I'm going to talk about the history and significance of West Beth and about what we learned in the process of preparing the National Register nomination. And then I hope there'll be time for comments and questions from both those of you who are residents and from those of you who are not. I should note that my focus is going to be largely on architecture and design and on the creation of the complex and not on the cultural history of those who've lived and worked at West Beth. And it's not that that's not equally important, it's just that's not my subject. West Beth is located on landfill created in the 19th century. And it's a little hard, I'm sure you can't see this here, but I can see it over here. There's a dotted line on this map that marks where the original waterfront was. And here's West Bend. So the waterfront came almost to the corner of Bank and Washington Street. So all of this was landfill that was created in the first half of the 19th century. The land west of Washington Street, adjoining the piers, developed as an industrial area, evident from the earliest building on the site, the former William Van Hook wood planing mill, completed in 1861 on the corner of West and Bank Streets, a building that later was used as a box factory, paint and oil works, a loft and storage warehouses, before it was purchased by Western Electric in 1897 as part of the assemblage that they made on the block. Western Electric was the electrical engineering research and manufacturing unit of the Bell Systems, a large telecommunication company that also included AT&T. In 1898, with the completion of the large building on West and Bethune Streets, Western Electric transferred its operations to this site. The new building contained corporate offices, manufacturing facilities, and laboratories. The Renaissance-inspired building was designed by Cyrus L.W. Eiglitz, a major architect of the day, not that well remembered today, but he was responsible for such important buildings as the Times Tower, now sadly lost, and the American Bar Association building, which you see one facade of over here, as well as several buildings designed for various components of the Bell system. He was sort of the official architect for the telephone companies and all its different, all the different parts of the telephone company. The complex was expanded first along Bank and Washington Streets by Eiglitz in 1899, and then on Bethune Street on the southwest corner of Washington Street in 1923 to 26. This extension was designed by McKenzie, Voorhees, and Gmelin, which was the successor firm to Eiglitz's own office. The office went through many, many, many name changes. It still exists today. It's Hain Lundberg Waller today. And the firm continued to get many, many commissions from the telephone company, including the Barclay Veazey building, which was the telephone company's headquarters in New York. Really beautiful building, built in 1925. Or built in 1928. On January 1st, 1925, before 51 to 55 Bethune Street was completed, the Western Electric became part of what was known as Bell Laboratories, the more comprehensive research and development arm of the Bell system. Bell Laboratories completed the building and occupied the entire complex. The final building addition to the complex was the construction of a building for sound recording experiments on Bank Street in 1928, designed by Bell Labs' own staff. And of course, as many of you know, a major alteration occurred in the complex when the New York Central Railroad erected the now famous High Line freight track in 1931 to 34 along the right-of-way running just west of Washington Street, taking the rails right through the buildings, right through the third floor. So they crashed right through the third floor of the building. The presence of the rail line running through the building established efficient shipping, at least for some goods, coming to and from the complex. I love this image. And I love the fact that although this section of the High Line is gone, the hole is still there. You can still read it. I know many of you probably have windows that look out on it. The Western Electric Bell Labs complex was devoted both to experimentation in pure science and to evolving ways in which to use science to further the technological and corporate advancement of the Bell system. So it was about technological advancement, but also discovering things for which Bell could make money. Western Electric and Bell Labs technological breakthroughs have been extraordinary at this site. I mean, it's just amazing what was done at this site, including, as many of you know, the development of the first vacuum tube, the invention of the condenser microphone, which became the mic for early radio, the technology for cross-continental telephone service, the principle for radar, high-fidelity recording, sound motion pictures, television transmission, color TV transmission, the digital computer, the transistor, a microwave radio relay system, direct distance dialing, transoceanic telephone cables, lasers, large superconducting magnets, satellite communication, and the one thing that I'm really glad never caught on was picture phones, which were invented. I know probably some of you are just like me. You like getting on the telephone in the morning, you know, you haven't shaved yet. I dread the notion of picture phones. All of this explains why this part of the complex was listed on the National Register in the 1960s, when it was just after Bell Labs abandoned the site. It was part of the complex was listed as nationally significant for science and technology, not for architecture, and predating, of course, the conversion. By the mid-1960s, Bell Labs had not only outgrown Greenwich Village site, but noise and vibrations from city traffic made certain experiments impossible here. So that thus, the company moved to a new suburban complex designed by Aero Saarinen in Holmdale, New Jersey, one of the most endangered buildings in America. Now, it's been abandoned. The threat was to completely demolish one of the great landmarks of modern suburban corporate development. And now the owner is like saying, well, maybe we'll save part of it, but it's still a little unclear what the future of this amazing complex is. The Greenwich Village complex was left vacant, and the future of the buildings in what had become a deteriorated area of underutilized industrial buildings was in doubt. Then the property came to the attention of William Zeckendorf, a prominent New York developer who often acted as a packager and promoter of projects. It was he who suggested to the advocates of subsidized housing complex for artists that this would be an appropriate site. The idea behind the creation of West Beth as a live-work community for low and moderate income visual and performing artists was that of Roger Stevens, the first chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, in conjunction with Jacob Kaplan, the founder of the J.M. Kaplan Fund. Among Stevens' earliest concerns as chair of the endowment was solving the problem of affordable housing for artists. Now, of course, he never solved it, but at least he made a dent, he made an attempt. This was considered a problem of national significance, and therefore became one of the first issues considered by the new National Endowment when it was established by President Johnson. The issue of creating houses for artists was first discussed at the second meeting of the National Council of the Arts, which was the predecessor to the endowment, in June 1965, when the council suggested that a priority should be projects that would help creative artists to obtain adequate and appropriate studio space that would also include living space as well. This concern was a result of an understanding that artists needed space both to live and to work, and they couldn't afford to rent both of them. This was not a new issue for artists. This was the reason behind the explosion of artist studio housing in New York in the first years of the 20th century along 67th Street between Central Park West and Columbus Avenue, where the Des Artistes, for example, is. It's also in Gainsborough on Central Park South. One of a whole series of buildings that were artists' live workspaces and places also where they could display work in the years before the art gallery movement began. So in 1965, the council authorized Stevens to initiate an immediate pilot project to remodel an old loft building or buildings into studios for artists' quarters. It's notable that from the inception, Stevens saw that a solution to the problem of artist housing lay in the conversion of old industrial loft space into live-work space. This reflects the trend that had begun in the late 1950s of artists moving into illegally into underutilized lofts. Like this 1960s photo of artists in a loft conversion in Soho. I love it because the way the furniture and the clothing, I mean, it's so 60s, that image. This development was, of course, most evident in the New York neighborhood of Soho. The National Endowment's idea of government involvement with artist housing was completely new in America, where all previous artist housing had either been created by private investment, either by artists themselves, or by speculative builders. This contrasted with the situation that Stevens was familiar with in Europe. He had traveled through Europe, and he had seen government-sponsored artist housing. Although a location for the artist housing was not specified in early council reports, it was clear that this project was to be undertaken in New York, the arts capital of the country. The council could only advise, though, on arts policy and had no funds for implementation. However, with the creation of the National Endowment for the Arts, in 1965, funding now became available. With the encouragement of Stevens, one of the endowment's first projects became carrying out the council's proposal to create housing and working space for artists. In order to successfully complete this project, Stevens turned to Jacob Kaplan, who had already had some limited experience with providing housing for artists and whose wife was very, very interested in this issue and had really inspired Jacob Kaplan to get involved in the issue of artist housing. Prior to Westbeth, the Kaplan Fund had supported several small-scale artist studio conversion projects, at, the first of which, beginning in 1963, was a former cast iron warehouse on the corner of Greenwich and 12th Street. It was a warehouse for an iron foundry that was converted into 12 units of live-work space. The building's still there, but it's no longer low-income artist housing. Kaplan also funded the conversion of the industrial building at 8 Worcester Street into an artist co-op for George MacUnis, the founder of the Fluxus Group. Westbeth would culminate Kaplan's interest in affordable housing and in artist housing. Stevens and Kaplan joined together to find the perfect venue for this visionary project, searching through underutilized and abandoned buildings and neighborhoods for an appropriate building. Joan Davidson, Jacob Kaplan's daughter, describes how, in the Oral History Project, she notes that, quote, "They went chasing all around New York, these two old geezers, looking for the ideal building. They hiked up and climbed down. They went under and over, and yes, it was just the two of them. Finally, following a lead provided by Zeckendorf, they settled on the former Bell Labs on West and Bethune Street, a location that resulted in the name of the complex, originally two words, West Beth, and then they just got merged together to create West Beth. At the time, the West Village neighborhood was an area of deteriorated and underutilized industrial buildings. Architect Todd Williams recalled that, quote, beyond Washington Street, there was nothing, absolutely nothing. With the site chosen, the National Endowment and the Kaplan Fund each provided $100,000 in development money for the project. And soon, more money was forthcoming from the endowment, from the Kaplan Fund, and from the Federal Housing Administration, which guaranteed a low-cost mortgage. The first time an FHA mortgage was given for housing planned for a specific professional group. As well, usually it was for income-based, but this time it was income-based and to a specific professional group. This pioneering housing project was definitely planned as a home for painters and sculptors, but Stevens was interested in the possibility of going beyond this limitation. He stated that, quote, "We especially want this to be a national center, not only for painters and sculptors, but undoubtedly will comprise the major portion of tenants, but also possibly for writers, dancers, musicians, filmmakers, and others." And it was Joan Davidson who expanded this vision, moving away from the idea of housing just for painters and sculptors to create a diverse community of visual and performing artists and writers. To create a full community, other facilities were also planned, including a theater, film studio, exhibition galleries, rehearsal rooms, sculpture gardens, projection rooms, dark rooms, and adjoining park and playground, not all of which, of course, ever came to fulfillment. Westbeth was not simply a project to house artists, but was seen at the time as an important investment in the future of New York as an urban center. You have to, you know, put this in perspective, the 60s, lots of urban problems, middle class moving out of the city, This was really showed some faith in New York and that New York's had a future as a major cultural center. It was, according to an early history of the National Council and the National Endowment, quote, in keeping with our emphasis on developing cities which serve the soul as well as the body. It was also hoped that West Beth would be a model emulated across the country, and indeed it was. One of the first and largest conversion projects that followed West Beth was the Piano Factory, the transformation of the abandoned Chickering & Sons Piano Factory in Boston into artist live workspace, which was undertaken as a direct result of the success of the New York project. And it unfortunately is no longer the low and moderate income housing that it began as. It is clear that the general success of West Beth and the national publicity that it received were a catalyst for other conversions of urban industrial buildings into artist housing, although never to the extent that Stevens had hoped. The National Endowment provided funds for West Beth to the J.M. Kaplan Fund directly, and therefore it became the fund's responsibility to see the project through to completion. Jacob Kaplan hired Dixon Bain, one of the people we interviewed, who had studied housing finance and development at MIT, as the administrator of the project. Kaplan's daughter, Joan Davidson, was named the fund's vice president and was placed in charge of overseeing the project and the fund's own investment in its success. Davidson and Bain, with the assistance of Mayor John Lindsay and his planning commissioner, maneuvered the project through the city bureaucracy and permit process. The first issue then after this was selecting the architect to design the conversion. Neither the National Endowment nor the Kaplan Fund had anyone specific in mind with this task, and there were no architects who had an established record at this kind of conversion. You know, now you can easily find architects who specialize in conversion, but in the 60s, there was nobody. In the fall of 1967, a relatively unknown architect named Richard Meyer was hired to design the conversion. Meyer had studied at Cornell and was a close friend of Jacob Kaplan's son, Richard. Richard Kaplan recommended Meyer, and he was hired. Joan Davidson recounts that, quote, Richard said, well, there's this bright kid that I know. We interviewed him, and we liked him. And we said, what the heck, let's give him a shot. It was so informal the way we did things then. So that's how Richard Meyer got his start. What the heck, let's give him a shot. West Beth brought Meyer publicity and several awards, literally launching a career that would reach the highest pinnacle of architectural success in both the United States and Europe. Meyer accepted the West Beth Commission, and as a result of receiving this commission, expanded his office, hiring notably a young graduate of Princeton, Todd Williams. The firm of Todd Williams and Billy Chan, I think, are among the finest firms working today. You probably all know them as the architects of the Folk Art Museum, the building down the block from the Museum of Modern Art with that wonderful poured bronze facade. As related by Williams, the first task for Meyer's office was to measure the building so that the constraints of converting the pre-existing structure into housing would become evident. They really had no idea what to do. They had no model, so they said, well, we better find out what we've got, and they spent months just like measuring every space there to figure out, well, what was this? What could they keep? What could be removed? After detailed examination of the Bell Labs buildings, three important decisions were made that created the special architectural character of the building. First, it was decided that a park would be created on Bank Street by demolishing some of the older buildings in the complex. And here you can see the design for the park. The trees, they're not shaped as they had hoped, but they've reached that level of maturity now that's actually in this design. The park was planted. The park, with its planting beds, concrete seating, and central fountain, now sadly gone. I have a collection of images of fountains that have been converted into planters. It's a really excellent landscape design of the period, with its juxtaposition of green planting space and hardscape with beautifully poured concrete embellishments. The concrete pieces are just gorgeous here, and they're just in amazing good repair. The space was brightened by painting the side walls of the three facing buildings white. It's kind of fading a little bit and peeling now, but this was an important aspect of the design, since the park facing south, sunlight would reflect off the bright walls, creating a light-filled space. And here you can see, you must know this, how much of what was there as part of the design survives. The second decision made by Meyer and his team was the creation of an inner courtyard open to the air. This was accomplished by demolishing a shipping dock. Meyer stated in our interview that the creation of this courtyard was, quote, the unifying theme at Westbeth. With the roof removed, the area could become a courtyard open to the sky while simultaneously providing a focal point for both residential units and commercial shops and galleries. The courtyard was embellished with a round concrete bench and a large Corbu-inspired concrete ramp leading from the ground level to what was supposed to be a second-story commercial space. Todd Williams, who designed the ramp, states that the ramp was, quote, a sort of macho thrust to say, I'm here, this is architecture. Actually, he's had second thoughts about the ramp. But it's, you know, it's a really key element and a very 60s element of the design. Very kind of aggressive piece of concrete in there. The new courtyard space was surrounded by commercial spaces, or was supposed to be surrounded by commercial spaces, that would be rented to galleries, restaurants, and other establishments that would pay rent to Westbeth. Unfortunately, the commercial space, which was to subsidize the residential uses and keep rents low, was not successful, since it was difficult to find commercial tenants willing to pay rent in what was, at the time the complex was completed, still a backwater. And you can see, you know, restaurant, commercial, and then tenant community facility. So Lear, in that, what was supposed to be the restaurant over here. The third and most significant design decision resulted in the creation of a mix of simplex or one-story and duplex or two-story units. The duplex is located in a large building on Bethune Street, were an adaptation of the duplex housing plan of Le Corbusier's Unité d'Habitation in Marseille. Le Corbusier's duplex plan had halls on every third floor, from which residents entered apartments and then went either up or down to larger second floor levels. Le Corbusier's work was extremely influential in America in the 1960s and had a strong impact on Meyer and his work, and especially on Todd Williams, a recent graduate from Princeton where people were obsessed with Corbu and his work. So this is the Unité here, and here's this is the plan. This is a cross-section through the Unité. It falls just like here, every third floor, and you entered and you either went down or you went up to your apartment. So that was the model for this. According to Williams, we were all very much interested in the work of Le Corbusier, and the Marseille block was the sort of an ideal for a young architectural community thinking that one could solve social problems and build beautiful buildings in an urban condition. And so, you know, here you can see, you all know this, how it was adapted for a three-bedroom and a two-bedroom unit. The plan was well received by contemporary commentators. A critic for Architectural Record commented that, quote, Meyer's manipulation of space has ingeniously increased the amount of apartment area available. In retrospect, Joan Davison feels that the spatial arrangement and the creation of the open space were the two most imaginative features of Meyer's design. She notes that Meyer, quote, took advantage of the total space by devising the system of duplexes that only preserve the long corridors on three floors. Excuse us, there's a water bottle up here. Competition from the water bottle. She notes that Meyer took advantage of the total space by devising the system of duplexes that only preserve the long corridors on three floors, and that the park on Bank Street was a beautiful design that opened to the street in a very generous and welcoming way. The locations of the fire balconies of the complex's courtyard indicate the presence of these duplexes. So, you know, for those of you who are not residents, every third floor does not have balconies, fire balconies. These are the because the apartment has a fire balcony either up or down. These rounded metal fire balconies, which substitute for the massive fire escapes that would otherwise have been necessary on these buildings of semi-fireproof construction, turned, according to Dixon Bain, the courtyard into something of an aesthetic plus rather than a huge negative. And of course they add that really interesting quirk to the design. Quirk in the best sense of the word. Architectural interventions were kept to a minimum, preserving as much of the original fabric as possible, including most walls, elevator shafts, the fireplace mantles in the executive offices, the marble floors, which you can see here, plasterwork and wooden enframements in the West Street lobby, the marble walls, Crawford plaster ceilings, and radiator grills in the Bethune Street lobby. Some of the interiors were highlighted with vivid paint colors, referred to by Todd Williams as day-glow colors. And these are a really important part of the concept. And you think about 60s design and the use of bright primary colors. That was very much what this came out of. Meyer's aim, within the constraints of cost and the built fabric of the old buildings, was, as he told a writer for The New Yorker, to give people incredibly large units for the rent, much larger than they could give than you could give nowadays by starting from scratch. He planned separate bathrooms in each unit, but otherwise spaces were generally kept open so that each artist and his or her family could subdivide the space as needed. This insistence that artists' live workspace was needed to be flexible and that traditional room arrangements would not work for such a population caused major, major problems with the Federal Housing Administration, which had strict rules about apartment design and infrastructure and which gave loans strictly governed by the number of bedrooms in each apartment. Finally, in order to placate the FHA, which was threatening not to give a mortgage, dotted lines were drawn into the floor plans indicating where walls could legally be erected to create the rooms required by the FHA. And I don't know how they persuaded the FHA to buy into this notion, but they did. And I'm sorry I don't have one of the designs with the dotted lines. The FHA was, as you can understand, hesitant to accept the notion that artists would want space without walls. They couldn't believe anyone would want to live that didn't have like three bedrooms that were really bedrooms. But after a great deal of persuasion and a number of statements by artists themselves, the FHA agreed to the unusual arrangement for counting bedrooms as dotted lines. The support of Mayor John Lindsay was crucial to the success of the project. Lindsay was especially interested in the arts, and he really shepherded this whole thing through city planning and the buildings department. He was so interested in artist housing that he actually was responsible for a project contemporary to West Beth. In 1967, planning began for converting the Peaks Mason Mint Factory on Cabin Plaza in Brooklyn Heights into at 20 Henry Street into a cooperative residence for 42 artists as a Mitchell Lama project. This project was completed in 1974. It took a long time to finish this, several years after West Beth opened. It was a factory that was converted into housing, and it had a very modern wall inserted into it. It was very interesting how modern design was incorporated into this building. And then this section here, this was a sculpture garden here. And then the owners bought out, eventually it was bought out of the Mitchell Lama. Everybody was evicted. It became market rate housing. And the new owner got a permit from the Landmarks Commission to build this in the sculpture garden. Despite my testimony in opposition to this, and my testimony was about, like West Beth, this is important to the history of preservation. And we really need to understand that as an important thing. I think this is under construction.
No, it's not.
No?
Stop.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Okay,
but
we'll start up again.
Yeah, we'll start up again. Yeah. In order to ensure that West Beth would be completed, the city initiated a radical new planning idea, establishing the first special zoning district, thus permitting living and working space in what was an area zoned for industrial use. New York City also agreed to a 70% tax abatement. There was great enthusiasm for West Beth among politicians and the complex's planners as the groundbreaking occurred in the summer of 1968. Not everyone was equally enthusiastic, though, about West Beth. Some artists complained that the creation of 382 apartments was too small to really solve the problem, of creating affordable housing for artists, while others noted that they rejected the idea of, quote, a homogeneous ghetto community. However, the critics were a minority, as most commentators were enthusiastic about the promise the complex held out to create an affordable artists' community. In order to carry out work on West End and to establish the new complex as an artist community, Joan Davidson founded the nonprofit West End Corporation as the entity that actually owned the complex. Once design, planning, and financing had been completed and permits had been acquired, the most complex issue before Davidson and her colleagues concerned who would move into West End's units and who would those artists be. In order to answer these questions, Davidson organized an advisory group made up of very, very prominent people in the arts. And as Joan says in her interview, some were more active than others. Some were, she hoped, would be active, but they were just became names on the letterhead. And others were very, very active. Among the most active were Thomas Hess, architecture and design curator at the Museum of Modern Art, art historian Ellie Monroe, art critic Catherine Kew, poet Stanley Kunitz, and Howard Moody, the minister of the Judson Memorial Church, which was also still today is an arts center. As Davidson recounts, the primary challenge, quote, was trying to figure out who lives in this place, what are the standards, what are the goals, what kind of community is it going to be? Is it going to be a little isolated dormitory, or is it going to be a regular neighborhood of the city? Is it going to be isolated like an artist colony, or is it going to be something else? A strong commitment was made to the goal previously stated by Stevens of creating a diverse community open to individuals from many disciplines who would be part of a larger community. It is significant that the organizers of West Beth sought professionals in the arts. Indeed, each applicant had to supply three people attest to his or her professional qualifications. They were not looking for famous names. The idea was to support those who were attempting to make a living as artists, not those who had already become successful. Over the years, of course, a number of well-known artists have lived at West Bend, but supporting the famous had never been the idea behind the community. Davidson and her advisory board also suggested the idea that artists who lived at West Bend for a certain number of years and had then established themselves might consider moving and opening the way for other artists. But this notion was never codified, and West Beth became, of course, a community of long-term artist residents. During the latter part of 1968 and during 1969, construction on the buildings proceeded at a rapid pace, and potential tenants were interviewed and selections made. People started moving into the building in late 1969, and the complex was officially opened on May 19, 1970. There was a waiting list for entry of over 1,000 names. "I really dig it here," said artist Harry Cusaris to the New York Times reporter Grace Lichtenstein in March 1970. "I never had a complete bathroom before in my life. Without wallowing in bourgeois luxury, it's really nice." The diversity of tenants planned by Davidson and the advisory committee was evident from the start. The New York Times reported that, quote, tenant rosters listed 150 painters, 49 sculptors, 27 photographers, 29 writers, 26 musicians, 38 actors, 18 dancers, 14 filmmakers, 11 playwrights, 7 poets, 9 composers, 7 printmakers, 3 designers, 4 graphic artists, 5 craftsmen, 4 theater producers, and hundreds of children and a lot of pets. The new residents immediately began creating their own spaces out of the open live-work units. Todd Williams, who was not only the architect on the project, but also one of the earliest residents, recalls that, "I immediately, in fact, did build in lofts for the children and tried to make as much advantage of the space as possible. Many artists used the space as planned for both living and working, but for some visual artists, the space was not big enough for their work, or the materials that they used were not conducive to use in a residential environment. This became a very hot issue. The size issue was partly the result of the fact that the FHA rules apportioned apartments depending upon family size, not on studio needs. Thus, a single painter who worked on large canvases could only receive a studio apartment, whereas a painter of miniatures or a writer with several children received a larger unit. In order to help alleviate the space problem, some studio space was created in the basement and in the 1861 building on the corner of West and Bank Streets, as somebody referred to it earlier. for these artists, but others were unhappy with the arrangement, creating some tension in the early years. As has been noted, finding commercial tenants for the space on the lower floor proved to be virtually impossible. However, the plan for West Bend also included a large studio space on the top floor of the building on the corner of Washington and Bethune Streets. In 1970, this space, as you all know, was rented to Merce Cunningham, which has maintained a studio in the space ever since. David Vaughan and Jean Craig, who were interviewed, both of whom worked for Merce Cunningham, read about West Beth, and according to Vaughan, the company was in need of a new studio space, end quote, so I called the number to ask if there was a space, a suitable space for a Merce Cunningham studio in West Beth, and they said there was something, and I went over to look. I might add that one of the people who was involved at the time was Howard Moody, who was the minister of Judson Memorial Church, and I was involved in performances at Judson, so I had this sort of an in there with Howard Moody. But Merce and I came over, and we clamored about in hard hats, and we rented the space. In 1970, the Cunningham Company did not have the funds to actively convert the space into a proper dance studio and also pay the rent. Thus, as Jean Craig recalled in her interview, the Kaplan Fund, quote, gave us a grant for the first 3 years so we could plan on raising money to be able to pay that rent in the future, which we did. The opening of West Beth in 1970 resulted in a great deal of publicity and commentary by critics in local newspapers, architectural journals, and popular magazines, and even in foreign publications. Almost all of the critical commentary was positive, most of it beginning by noting that this was the largest rehabilitation project in America and the world's largest residential complex. Critics were especially impressed with how the project, reusing old industrial buildings, set a new standard for the creation of urban housing. The most important synopsis of the establishment of West Beth and analysis of its success was, of course, provided by the great New York Times architecture critic A. Louise Huxtable in a review published just a few days before the official opening. After relating the history of the planning, Huxtable proclaimed that no trumpet sounded when West Beth triumphed over the system, but they should have, since West Beth's open apartment plans represent a first step out of the steel trap of FHA rules, one of the most powerful and deadly implements of domestic design. She felt that Mr. Meyer's architectural solution is exemplary, especially in the creation of duplexes and in the bold and sensitive use of color. Important ground has been broken at West Beth, she concluded, and valuable lessons learned. Whether or not this is the artist's promised land, its neatly shod sponsors are showing the way. West Beth won several awards in the years immediately after its completion, attesting to the design success of the project, including a prestigious AIA Honor Award. The jury stated that, although no radical departure from anonymous architecture, this is an outstanding example of building and neighborhood preservation through the rehabilitation of an obsolete yet worthy structure to new uses. The jury commends this approach for the economical provision of housing through such reclamation and renovation, and advocates for the strong social commitment it expresses be applied to housing for other needy groups. So this is those kind of manifesto that, you know, this is what we should be doing in our cities. West Bend remains a major development, important in the history of housing and the history of New York as an art center. The significance of West Beth was recognized as recently as August 2007 in an article in the Architects newspaper, which commented, and it's a really good way to close, "It is a well-known fact that New York City is fast becoming a place where art is sold and not made, a city where the creative class can no longer afford housing. It wasn't always so." This year marks the 40th anniversary of West Beth, which has 383 units of affordable artist housing in the West Village, is one of Richard Meyer's earliest works and a model that is more relevant than ever. Thank you. Maybe generate some discussion here, because some of you might be able to answer some of the questions that I can't answer. I see a hand back here.
To pick up on what you were saying, I understand
as you keep saying, this is supposed to be a thing for artists. I've been hearing that the children of those artists who could never get into Westbeth are now taking over the apartments, that it may or may not be part of the condo or whatever the federal is. But at the rate it's going, this will no longer be housing for artists. And my question is, how will we stop?
That's really beyond my my knowledge.
That's very true.
I know that this is happening, but I don't know. I don't know enough about HUD's rules to answer that. Yeah.
Do you know if there are any existing plans of, say, what the colors were? Are there any records that can be accessed in the event that we want?
Well,
to
you know, the best record is that Todd Williams. And Richard Meyer can tell you what the colors were. And the other thing is...
Are they accessible?
Are they accessible?
Yeah.
They both work in New York. You know, Richard Meyer, for a while, I know a lot of... over the years, a lot of people have tried to interview Richard Meyer about Westbeth, and he was not very forthcoming. But he really loves talking, apparently, with... I didn't do the oral histories, but he really loved talking about this, and he was really kind of into it. And Todd Williams could be nicer. And I'm sure... That they'd be interested in. And then the other thing to do is once, you know, he can go in and say, oh yeah, this was red, this was blue, but the colors are all under there. They're all under the layers. They were never removed. They were just painted over. And, you know, you could hire a paint conservator to come in and give you very detailed paint study. So it's very, very possible to do that. That kind of work. But I think the best thing would be to walk around with Todd and a microphone and have him tell you what the colors were. Yeah, it's my hand over here.
You may be interested to know that an attempt was made a few years ago to contact Richard Meyer to get a scheme of the colors, and he refused to answer it. I don't know whether it was the board or tenants that attempted to do this, but
the oral history that Richard Meyer gave the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation, he said he didn't remember the colors, and that he hadn't taken any kind of notes or taken any pictures about what was there. So I don't know if Todd knows the answer to that. They don't address that in his oral history, but it would be a good question to ask him if it's something he can.
Yeah, and then there's always going to be...
We do have the colors.
Okay.
And the colors exist because we redid the ceiling based on the original chips. And it was tough to find the manufacturer of those colors. But the color chips do exist somewhere in the office. That's how the ceiling that you saw was repainted with the original colors from the original color chips.
Well, you did a fantastic job because it sings when you're in there.
We have the chips. What we don't have is a total plan. The colors are underneath. What we did say when I led a fight to save was the lobby ceiling. Mm-hmm. And those... The companies that sold those paints were contacted, both the company in the Midwest and the company in Brooklyn that sold those colors, the fluorescence and the earth colors. We have the chips of all the other colors for those who are interested in what has been lost was a detailed plan of exactly where all the colors were. However, those colors, for those who are interested, do exist. In the chips and underneath the walls, underneath the paint.
Well, I'm thrilled that there's so much interest in the colors because I think that's a really important aspect of the 60s aspect of the design that's so important here.
Yeah.
Yes?
How come the piano factory in Boston, and you know, or whatever that play in the piano, why was that converted to now, I guess, regular housing and Westbeth was able to be kept?
Because it wasn't private. Development. It was a private investment that was done. I actually had a student 2 years ago who did a thesis on the creation of artist studios in Boston, and looked at why they succeeded and then ultimately didn't succeed, and then what the city of Boston has an active program to create artist housing, And they kind of learned from why the piano factory, and there's another one, I can't remember the name, why they succeeded and then failed. But it just got converted into market housing. Yes.
You told us about three or four artists housing in other places in New York City and the one in Boston who are no longer artists housing. And we also know Manhattan Plaza. The artists that live there are still there, but those who didn't qualify for Section 8 are paying a much higher rent, and it's also revolving. And this is a big concern to us. We really want residents to stay as artists housing for eternity.
Well, that's why it's so important.
Getting this landmark status and the historic designation, will that help us in that goal?
Yes and no.
Oh,
no, the no part is that neither the National Register nor the Landmarks Commission can deal with use issues. And in fact, the Landmarks Law specifically says you can't deal with use issues. But the fact that that very strongly in the National Register nomination, it talks about that this is that the reason this is nationally significant is because of the conversion into artist housing. So that is right out there. That's why it's not just that it's very significant because it's such an early conversion project. But what makes it even more significant was all the social issues around that. And the Landmarks report has not been written, but I'm sure that will be a central aspect of the Landmarks Commission report too. So that helps as ammunition. That it's recognized that that's why the complex is so important.
Who will be writing the...
The staff of the commission, this research staff, writes the designation reports. Yes?
Is West Bath rent stabilized?
No.
No. No, so I'm not going to answer that. Lots of people here can answer that.
We're HUD-regulated.
HUD-regulated. Yeah, I saw a hand with that. Yes? I wasn't planning on publishing it per se, but you can actually download the National Register nomination on the Greenwich Village site website. It's all based on the National Register nomination. So you can read that. Yes.
Well, I think what I had to tell you is when you said Mr. Wickensall suggested that Robert Stevens would be interested in using West Bath, it was because he had been defeated in the Board of Estimate hearing where I was present. And he wanted to, Bell was willing to sell it for $2 million. And he said it would take me $2 million just to pull it down. I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to put up this great big pillar and it will go up and up and up and up, and everybody started falling around, laughing, banging their heads. The men of the Board of Estimate couldn't help laughing. And Westbridge Committee sent 300 people to that meeting. We defeated earlier a plan to completely flatten the West Village because it was a slum, which it wasn't. And that was on our last public act, but we actually, and Jane was there, stopped Leckensdorf getting the okay from the Board of Estimates to tear West Bath down and put up one single needle, as they were called. So you always have to think that was the hinge, really.
Yeah, well, Zeckendorf was a major, major New York developer in the 50s and the 60s, and that's what he did. Once that was defeated, he already knew about this project, and then so he suggested it as for another use.
Yeah,
absolutely. Anything else? Okay, well, thank you all.